This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. A comedian walks into a museum. Director says, "Can I help you?" Comedian says, "Yeah, I'm here to make jokes about science." Director says, "You can't be serious." Brian Mallow is that comedian, and while he can be serious, he can also be very funny. He calls himself the Earth's premier science comedian, and he's been making scientists and normal folks laugh for years. And if you want to see how it's really done, you can check Brian out at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. He's the new curator of the Daily Planet, and we will find out what that is right now as we meet Brian Mallow. Welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Great to be here, Frank.
Tell us about your new job.
I'm very excited about it, and it's a little different for me. As you said, my background is primarily in stand-up comedy, but it's morphed into being a science communicator, and I mostly entertain scientists, or I talk to general audiences and have fun with science with them. So this job, it's almost like everything I've done for a couple decades has prepared me for it. The new NRC at the Museum of Natural Sciences is amazing. It's just architecturally, it's just beautiful. The technology there is amazing. And that's not even, we'll get into the staff and the scientists there.
You've got this giant screen, like this 40-foot, essentially this screen with all kinds of things going on. And then it's, at the base of that is this newsroom where you're going to be doing kind of the day's events.
So the Daily Planet itself, it's the SECU Daily Planet, is this like three-story multimedia theater. And it's in, everyone has seen it, I'm sure, downtown, the Big Globe. We are inside that. I feel almost like a supervillain, you know? Like, and now also, now that I've been given my key card and I have 24-hour access to the building, I feel like, you know, in the middle of the night, I could go in there and somehow blast that Earth away and sail off into the universe with it. But it's amazing, just as amazing inside as it is outside. There's this new system that was designed specifically for this venue. It has all this computer-controlled stuff and the six projectors that merge to create. It's not IMAX, but like IMAX, mm-hmm. you know, it's a tall format. It's tall and wide, filling up a good portion of that sphere. And they've made these beautiful multimedia packages. So we'll be running cool media in there all the time, but also presenting live speakers. And we did that for the first time during the 24-hour opening. And every hour on the hour, we had a new speaker. And I emceed part of that along with Meg Lauman and David Kroll, the director and the director of science communications.
So tell us how you became a science comedian. Did you set out to do this?
Not specifically science. My love of science is older than my interest in being a comedian. I grew up, I was a little science kid. I was a very curious kid. At least that's what the neighbors said. You know, I think they meant well. And I was very much into science fiction and science. When I got into stand-up comedy, it was only natural for that to inform my act. So if you ever saw me, I wasn't calling it science comedy, but you'd hear me make some geeky references. I would, if I wasn't talking about a science topic, it was pretty common for me to at least make a funny reference or draw from the language or metaphors of science and maybe even use them absurdly. Like I would say, and I was always doing like jokes like this, that whenever a long time ago, I noticed whenever my mom would lose weight, my dad would gain weight. And when my dad lost weight, my mom gained weight. It was like the conservation of mass within our family. So I had a theory that you never actually lose weight. Right. You just give it to somebody else. Fat can be neither created nor destroyed. One of the basic laws. So So that's not factually true, but it's like an absurd use of a science concept. And that was just fun for me. And I would make jokes like that. And sometimes I'd come up with a slightly more obscure one that might not work in a nightclub, which is where I worked. So it would sort of sit on the shelf gathering dust until I did a gig for, say, Apple or Dell or Microsoft, and there would be a bunch of engineers in the audience, and I'd pull out all these obscure jokes, and they would kill. And I'd go, I need to find that audience. And it took forever, but it was sort of a branding issue. Finally, I hit on the phrase science comedian, and I found that the domain, the web domain, sciencecomedian.com, was available, which also – I didn't know if that's a good sign or a bad sign.
Somebody had not taken science comedian?
Yes. And so, but you know what I mean? Like, that's maybe a bad sign. Exactly. Maybe there's no need. Maybe that's awful real estate. Yeah. Maybe there's no need for it. But it turned out to be a very good decision. So it's not like I ever said, like the marketing department at brianmallow.com never said, maybe we should, people need science and people like comedy. Science community, it was really very a natural evolution. I was already doing it. It just took a long time for me for it to crystallize and call it science comedy. And once I started doing that, it opened a lot of doors. People started coming to me because they would, you know, they would do a search online and they would find me. So ultimately, I started making videos, science videos for Time Magazine's website. And those are kind of fun.
And you do conferences and yeah. that sort of thing. And so,
yeah, I'm more from my work used to primarily be in nightclubs, colleges, private gigs. And then it became mostly private stuff, science events, science conferences. Science festivals are a big thing that have become real popular. And in fact, you know, we are in the midst of the North Carolina Science Festival.
Right.
And tons of amazing events all over the state. And so those became the thing I mostly do now. And I started making science videos. And also, someone who's going to be here Thursday for the festival, I actually contribute audio pieces to Neil deGrasse Tyson's radio program.
Well, and you came to his attention, too. He noticed you.
Yeah, you know, that was an amazing thing to check my email one day and see Neil deGrasse Tyson. I had an email from Neil deGrasse Tyson. And it's like, is this a joke? What is this? And he just dropped me a note, having seen some videos on YouTube, and just said I was hilarious. And we corresponded occasionally. Like when I started doing the Time videos, I did one on an astronomy topic, and I sent it to him. And he wrote back kind of something funny. He said, for a minute there, I mistook you for an actual journalist. So he's very funny.
Oh, some of the funniest stuff I ever read is in the pages of the New York Times. These days, I can't tell if I'm reading The Onion or The Times anyway.
I know.
It's a little wacky. But let me ask you this. You tell a story about going to the movies with a friend of yours. Yes. And I think this illustrates. So first I should have you tell the story.
Okay.
And then kind of what happens when you tell that to a group.
Yeah, I say that I saw a movie with a friend of mine. And I don't really like seeing movies with him because he always has to sit in the front row because he thinks he gets to see the movie before anybody else. And you can't argue with him either because he always has the same last word. The speed of light is finite, Brian. All right. And that's true. The speed of light is finite, but it's very fast. In fact, it's 186,000 miles per second. So this is what I told Chuck. If you had a theater 186,000 miles long, you would only see the movie 1 second before the guy in the last row. And he said, yeah, but you'd hear it a week and a half before him. And you probably wouldn't get your popcorn for years.
So he's constantly trumping you. Now, what's interesting is you say when you tell that story in to a group of scientists, you get a lot of reactions. Some people laugh right away.
Yeah.
But then something else happens. There's always one guy.
You know, I get asked a lot about what kind of – do scientists even have a sense of humor? And what the one thing I do have to say about them is some of them – and I'll qualify things to say that some of them sometimes have a very literal sense of humor. So everything has to be accurate. And, you know, most comedians just have to be funny. Their jokes don't even really have to make sense. They can be loaded with flaws. If it just catches people off guard and makes them laugh, that's all that matters. But if you call yourself a science comedian – you're going to be held to a different standard, and people are going to expect you to be funny and literally and scientifically and mathematically accurate. So that's the point. That joke is a great example of something really funny that happens because comedians want, more than anything, laughter. That's what we want. But clapping, sometimes you get clapping after a joke, and that's nice. Second to laughter, that's nice. But what I sometimes get, and what I've realized is a compliment, and I should just accept it as a compliment. Well, you know, that's my choice to choose to see it as a compliment, is that sometimes after, like, that speed of light joke, I'll look out and I'll see some scientists thinking. They're like, they're not reacting yet, but you see them kind of looking up and rubbing their chin maybe, and they're kind of deep in thought, and then they kind of slowly start to nod their head because they have found the joke sound. Not necessarily funny, not brilliant, but the joke is okay, yeah, oh, they admit, yeah, the joke is sound. They might check the math later when they get home.
I was going to say, they're sitting there on the calculator saying, not a week, actually, it's 10 days.
But sort of like back of the... envelope calculation. Yeah. They've decided the joke is sound, and they can, and you may carry on, comedian. Go, please carry on with your next joke. Yeah.
So that's the thing. I think people have this perception somehow that comedians have a particular deficiency. They're not. If they have a sense of humor, we rarely see it. But that's not true, right? Yeah,
no. You know, I don't. Okay. Stereotypes. There might be some scientists that are a little stodgier and have less of a sense of humor. But boy, really, in my experience, here's what's absurd about that. To ask me, do scientists have a sense of humor? Of all the careers I can think of, scientists, more than anyone, they've maintained their childlike wonder with the world. They've chosen a career, clearly not for money. They've chosen a career, and not only a career, but a life about, you know, chasing down these weird little mysteries, like why a bug does that, you know, strange behaviors. They're just the most childlike, except for maybe clowns. And I hate to even bring that up in the same sentence, but why don't people ask, do accountants have a sense of humor? Do lawyers have a sense of humor? Do anything but, you know, stockbrokers, anything but scientists? Because in my experience, and this is certainly borne out by the new staff at the NRC, they are amazing, vibrant, passionate people, and they're funny and fun. They usually have other interests that are interesting, and so, yeah.
And it's about communication as well. It's not just about funny, and we're going to talk about that. We'll take a break here and come back and talk about the mission to communicate science to a broader public. Humor is part of that, but it's also a much larger picture. We're talking to Brian Mallow. He is the science comedian and new curator of the SECU Daily Planet at the Natural Research Center at North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking with Brian Mallow, the science comedian, and he's the new curator at the SECU Daily Planet at the Natural Research Center at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. And I think you're here in part, Brian, because the museum, it seems, has a mission to communicate science to the public.
Yeah, absolutely. The Nature Research Center has a staff of researchers that are going to be doing original research, but a huge part of the mission, and it's even reflected in the actual building itself, architecturally, the Daily Planet itself, that big globe is suggestive of the global mission of communication. So, of course, there's a mission to communicate science locally to schools in North Carolina, to children and children of all ages. But there's really, we have the technology to communicate and to via Skype and other technologies, and there's other web networks to get the stuff out through iTunes and through YouTube, through every kind of podcasting network to get the message out. And that is, everyone understands that there's a mission to do original research and there's a mission to communicate the science to the world.
There are going to be scientists working in essentially glass cubicles,
yes,
right? And so when you walk by, you can actually poke your head in, at least put your nose against the glass and watch them making science.
Right? Yeah, it's really cool. And actually, there's more interactivity than that. So there is four floors, and there's a range of labs. There's an astronomy lab and a paleontology lab and a biodiversity lab and a genetics lab. And in addition to that, there's also these investigate labs that are very specifically interactive, and their groups, they'll be pre-scheduled groups of students will be able to have very hands-on interactive experiences in the labs. But like you said, you can just walk by any time and peer in and see scientists doing their work, and they'll come out and interact with you, invite you in. You can during the opening, there was a lot of handling of insects. There were some really cool exotic insects that were you could totally interact with, and people are happy to answer your questions.
Let me ask you this. Because of the way technology is moving, you talked about YouTube and the fact that NASA now connects with a lot of classrooms. Mm-hmm. You can talk to people on Skylab and whatever. I mean, do we really need a building anymore to have interactive science?
Well, yeah. I mean, we do, you know, have students go to school and they learn about some stuff. But no, I think this is entirely different. This building, everything about it is about engagement with science. So when you walk in here, you can't help but be wowed by it's so beautiful inside. And there's so many interesting things on every floor and everywhere you turn on every topic, from dinosaurs to climate change to genetics to butterflies. There's just so much going on there. And yeah, I clearly think that science education and this communication part is hugely important, and that there's, and more than that, that there's a need for it in the United States and the world today.
Well, and I think it gets at some of that reputation that scientists have, that they don't particularly need social skills and perhaps haven't developed them very well. And the notion of being alone in the lab with your mice is what reinforces that. But when people are together, you see the reason for the science. Here's why we're doing this, is because people on this planet need to know about global warming and what it does. And if you're all standing there together, you realize, oh, there's something at stake here. His life and her life and his life. These people who I'm actually sharing this space with, many of them strangers. So the business of communication, let me ask you about that. Is there a real connection here between what a comedian does? I mean, is there a way that you can sort of train a scientist who may be better in the lab than out there on that sofa with the guests? And is there something comedy brings to that?
Actually, yes, it almost sounds absurd, but I have done some work. A few years ago, I was contacted by the NRC in Canada, and that's the the National Research Council of Canada, to see if I would give some workshops to help their scientists communicate to the public. And it was a very fruitful experience. We did it a couple times. And when I had some meetings with the National Science Foundation here, the NSF here in the United States, they had me actually give some presentations on communicating science with humor. So the whole idea was that I definitely am not going to try to tell scientists to be comedians. I did not try to tell them to tell jokes, but you can use humor in your presentations. And the reason I was hired to do this is that some of these scientists have a lot of experience speaking in public, but it's mostly to their colleagues, to their peers, right in their own field. And it's a little different when you're talking to people outside your field, and especially a general audience that aren't even scientists. So how do we engage with them? How do we present our information and get across? Because sometimes, just like anyone, we can take for granted what we know and not realize, hey, you need to communicate that. So I found there's some interesting connections between comedy and communication. My favorite thing to talk about is analogies. Analogies are a general communications tool. They're just great for making a point clear, making a comparison clear, or they are a comparison for making a concept clear. But obviously analogies are great in comedy too, and it can be anything. Like I actually have a little joke about some airports where you're not allowed to smoke except in those little glassed in rooms, and I always thought that looked like a terrarium in which you're able to view the smokers in a recreation of their natural habitat. And and I just sort of flesh out the whole thing, like a little bit of a zoo experience. I'm sure they feel very funny being restricted to that little chamber, and it feels very funny to walk by and see them in there. And you feel like there should be a little machine where you put in a quarter and get a cigarette and toss it out to them or something. But like analogies can make something funny, but they can also just make a concept clear. Right. And sometimes, some science topics are a little esoteric and they need to be made clear.
And it would seem to me that any comedian needs to know that there is a fund of knowledge out there. There are points of reference that everybody's going to have in this audience. And if you don't, really, these jokes are going to go flat. So I have to make some assumptions about what you know. And then there's a little context clue. You tell a joke, for instance, about it's a little one-liner. Maybe I'll have you do it. It's about I believe it's a room temperature semiconductor.
Oh, the superconductor. Yeah, that's the one you played at the head of the show. I guess that I have a series of somewhat corny jokes that they're a standard old. I'll tell you what, the best story is why I even have these corny jokes.
Yeah.
It's because I did a show in Washington, D.C. at the Marion Koshland Science Museum, and it was very successful. And they said, we'd like you to come back next year, but could you do a new show that goes along with our exhibit on infectious disease? So they're asking me to do a comedy show.
What's more funny than the infectious disease?
Who even gets asked these questions? But I said yes because I wanted the gig, right? So I'm like, okay, yes, I can do that. And then I went home and I'm like, whoa, can I do a show on infectious disease? What did I just commit to? And then I thought, you know what? Bill Cosby could probably do half an hour on having a cold. Yeah. And then I realized I'm not Bill Cosby. Who is? How very few people are. And I was like, oh, this is going to be hard. But in the end, and collaborating with my wife is actually my creative partner as well, we came up with a pretty good bit of material. But part of it, I hit on this idea. There's an old structure of, you know, any something walks into a bar and what the bartender says. And I came up with a whole series of them. And actually, this brings in the analogy, because the one that I kick them off with is actually about viruses. And I'm first explaining a little bit about how fascinating a virus is. And I use an analogy to make it clear and also hopefully humorous, because a virus is, it's not even certain. It's not really a complete life form. In order to do everything a life form does, it has to get inside another cell, and then it takes over the cell's machinery and turns it to its own uses. So I said it's sort of like a hostile takeover, like your cells under new management. And it's kind of like going into a Nike factory and having them make, like, you know, Twinkies or something, you know. Or so when you think too hard about this kind of joke, here's the kind of joke you come up with. And I said, a virus walks into a bar. Bartender says, we don't serve viruses in this bar. The virus replaces the bartender and says, now we do. And an infectious disease walks into a bar. Bartender says, we don't serve infectious diseases in this bar. The infectious disease says, well, you're not a very good host. And yes, they're knowing that. Yes, they're corny. I'm the first one to admit. But one of the favorites is two bacteria walk into a bar. The bartender says, we don't serve bacteria in this bar. The bacteria say, but we work here. We're staff. But the joke is sound. Frank, the joke is sound. And it's admittedly corny. And I'll even say, like, sometimes people groan. I'll go, yes, groaning is acceptable. But do you actually want the room temperature superconductor?
Do that one, because I think that one illustrates, because we sort of know what viruses are. But room temperature superconductors, many of us in the audience never heard of until
this moment. A room temperature superconductor walks into a bar. The bartender says, we don't serve any superconductors in this bar. The room temperature superconductor leaves without putting up any resistance.
Now, see, what you've done, it seems to me, I learned what a room temperature superconductor does, even though I didn't, because you're right. The frame is very old, so that there you and I have a – we've got a foundation. We can work off of that. Now I can put it in context and say, I guess room temperature superconductors are resistance-free. That must be the cool thing about
it.
So in a sense, you can not only sort of trade on what I already know, but actually take me a step or two forward, because we start with a common context, a frame, and then I just put it together if I'm with you.
Well, that was very cool to hear that feedback from you, because in the case of like that one, for example, I don't stop to discuss it afterwards. I go on with a series of these jokes. But it's nice to know that someone might put that together and go, oh, kind of back engineer the joke. It's like, if that's what the punchline is, this is what superconductors must be. So that's fascinating to hear. Other jokes, I explicitly do it. So I have a joke where I say, I used to be an astronomer, but I got stuck on the day shift, which sucks because you don't discover anything good. And now I can just leave it at that. But with some audiences, especially science savvy audiences, I have to say this, but it's a great starting point. It's like a kicking off point to discuss this subject, because the fact is there are astronomers that work on the day shift. First of all, solar astronomers study the sun, which is a star, and radio astronomers study a part of the frequency, the spectrum of light that's not visible. So they can work during the daytime. And furthermore, turns out today, really almost all astronomers work on the day shift because they can operate remotely a telescope on the other side of the world where it's night, and it's everything is digitized and computer operated. So the truth is today that pretty much all astronomers work on the day shift. And that romantic image of an astronomer with his eye to the in a dark room or outside with his eye to the eyepiece, mostly amateur astronomers do that. And professional astronomers mostly work on the day shift. And when I say amateur, that's not even dismissive, because astronomy is one of the few fields where amateurs make contributions all the time. They discover comets and asteroids and interesting new things. There was something just recently, like a cloud structure, something different on Mars, or it happens with Jupiter. And often it's there's so many thousands of amateur astronomers around the world that they're often the ones to make the first spotting of something.
When you talked about getting into comedy first, then realizing that your stuff was pretty potent when it was in science, tell us about the construction of a joke and if it changes at all when you have a kind of a topic that you want to stick with.
Yeah, you know, starting out as a comedian, if there's a spectrum between entertainment and education, I only ever had to entertain. You know, no comedian has to educate. Now, there have always been interesting, someone like George Carlin and someone and Bill Maher, who are social commentators, and maybe they impart a lot of information in addition to being entertaining. But I never had an obligation to educate until I started calling myself a science comedian. And all of a sudden, there was an expectation and also an interest in my part to impart some information. So the process of joke writing, it can happen a few different ways. To anyone who tries to create, to sit down and face a blank piece of paper and fill it with anything interesting is hard enough. To fill it with a humor, to face that page and go, oh, how do I make something funny? So a lot of times a comedian will read the newspaper or watch television, watch the news. You get exposed to stuff. I mostly now read, it's what I do for fun, but it's also work. I like to read about science. So it's whether in magazines, books, or online, I just immerse myself in all this science stuff. Sometimes it inspires a joke right away. Other times it doesn't, but you know what? It just goes in the hopper. And hopefully one day I'll be in a conversation with someone like you and boom, this thing will come out of my head that I planted there a long time ago. It'll connect with something new and it gives me the basis to make those analogies and metaphors and just connections. And that's a lot of what comedy is. It's connecting things and it's me making a connection in your head that surprises you. And for some reason it elicits that strange sound we call laughter.
Now, when you are talking to a science audience, people who know their stuff, do you ever get heckled because you're for inaccuracies or anything else?
Yeah, that can't. So the other thing is sometimes I sit down with a topic. So for instance, Neil deGrasse Tyson's radio show, his episodes are themed. So he gives me a theme and I have to write to the theme. So and other times I'm, let's say, hired by the American Chemical Society. And I know that I need to write some chemistry-related humor. So sometimes it can't be so haphazard, but so many jokes come out of just being in a spontaneous conversation with a friend, and it just pops up. You're comfortable and relaxed. Humor comes out. If I have to actually address a topic, yeah. And then not only that, but like you said, if I'm going to perform in front of these chemists or physicists, to a general audience, I can probably get away with a lot. But they are going to bust me if it's not scientifically accurate. So, for instance, one time, it was really a general audience, but there were scientists in the room. And I was just talking about the heat in Arizona. And it had been 125 degrees at Lake Havasu. And I was like, 125 degrees? That just sounds like science fiction. You're talking about the surface of Venus. And from the back of the room, someone goes, no, Venus is much hotter than that. And yeah, okay. So, you know, the fact is, yeah, I actually knew that. And I was using a comedic device called exaggeration. And I feel like I should be able to do that. But that goes back to that issue where this they needed me to be literally accurate. It's hard to be funny and also not use exaggeration and not use other comedic devices. So
You do the research? You do the math on some of these jokes?
Oh, yeah. That speed of light joke?
Yeah.
I could not intuit what the answer was for that. So the math involved was light travels 186,000 miles in 1 second. And then I had to know, well, how long does it take sound to travel? Mm-hmm. To write the joke, I had to do some math. And I had double-checked it a couple times. And it turns out it takes approximately a week and a half for sound to travel that same 186,000 miles. Of course, now that joke has been nailed on a couple counts too, because 186,000 miles, well, light can travel through a vacuum, but sound cannot. Sound is a vibration through a medium. So if you have a theater, but you know, I did say if you had a theater 186,000 miles long, which presumably would have air in it,
but
you expect people to be there.
What's the humidity?
There is the humidity, and that can affect the speed of sound.
Of course
exactly.
It can.
So, and furthermore, but I had a kid on YouTube say something great about this. He pointed out that if you were in the back of that theater, so the sound was coming presumably from the front. This is presuming they don't have speakers surround sound. But if the sound is coming from the front and takes 186,000, for you to hear it in the back row, that sound would probably crush the people in the front row.
Oh. It
would be so loud that it would be destructive for it to propagate 186,000 miles. I thought that was hysterical. And he had said that maybe he would do the calculations and get back. I never did hear from him again, but I thought that was a great idea. Maybe I need to talk to some physicists and see what math would have to be done to come up with that. What comedian even thinks this way?
Get the kids to break down the math comedians, the science comedians'
yes.
jokes.
I think it was like a four.
That would be great. Yeah. That would be terrific.
You know, I have another joke that I love to tell about getting older and I have gray hair. But I've had gray hair a long time. I don't care. I don't care if it goes blue. I don't care if it goes ultraviolet. In fact, that's what I'm going to say if I lose my hair. I'm not bald. I have hair. It's just outside your visible spectrum. And I've told that to groups of enthusiasts and scientists for several years. And it took a young kid from Serbia to tell me via YouTube, you know, what I just said was my hair is outside your visible spectrum. He said, that wouldn't reveal your bald head. Instead, it would just probably appear black. If it, because the hair would be, according to the joke, the hair is there. It's just reflecting ultraviolet light that you don't see. So to your eyes, which can't see into the ultraviolet, it would just be like black hair. So that was an interesting little flaw in that joke. Now, the truth is, I've told it hundreds and hundreds of times, and it's never affected its ability to get laughs.
Yeah.
This kid in Serbia,
out of your audience. You're fine. You sound great. My guest is Brian Mallow. He is the science comedian and curator at the SECU Daily Planet New Nature Research Center at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. We're going to talk more about that as our program continues on the state of things if you stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today talking to Brian Mallow, science comedian and new curator at the SECU Daily Planet, the Nature Research. You know what it really is. It's the Nature Research Center at the North Carolina. There's nothing funny about the name of this place, I want to tell you. The Nature Research Center, North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, and of course the new wing just opened up. The Daily Planet just opened, big 24-hour grand opening. A spectacular building. I want to talk a little bit more, though, about your career before you came here, because I know at one point you had a Vatican scientist, which sounds like an oxymoron to begin with, in the audience, and that was kind of a fun event for you.
Yeah, so I've performed at a lot of interesting conferences and events. So I was once performing, and this was actually held at the Googleplex in Mountain View. And the audience was amazing scientists of all types and communicators. And I was going to tell a joke about Pluto. And I realized that there was this scientist, one particular astronomer. There was at least one astronomer in the room, and he was an astronomer from the Vatican. His name's Brother Guy Consomagno. And he is the curator. He's also a curator of the Vatican Meteorite Collection, which is I just think that's an amazing thing to have on your business card. Curator of the Vatican. Did you even know that the Vatican had a meteorite collection?
No, but when you think about it, stuff falls from heaven, they've got to have it, I suppose.
You know what? Yeah, two things. First of all, I did just talk to a scientist who, at the 24-hour opening, one of the people I interviewed, Dave Jewett, is a studies meteorites and comets, and they have a world class. Their collection is well known amongst astronomers. But yes, I think in that way, they feel like it falls from the heavens and it's a way of being closer to God. They're studying. It's a way of touching something that's beyond the earth. But he's a scientist. He's MIT and Harvard graduate. And has even taught it at one or both of those places. And he's also got a great sense of humor. He's really funny. So again, a good counter to that. Do scientists have a sense of humor? This guy could have been a comedian. He became a scientist. And this one point came up about whether Pluto should have been demoted. You know, everyone was so, oh, why? What do you have against Pluto? You know, cold, distant. I don't want to be in a plutonic relationship. Those are just some of the excuses, I think. And so I stopped midstream to go, oh, Brother Guy, what did you think about Pluto being demoted? And he said, I was on the committee that decided. And the room laughed and then hissed him. And it was a beautiful moment. It was one of the funniest things I've ever had happen on stage. Funnier than it sounds right now, I think. But it's also the sort of thing that never would have happened in my early – that couldn't have happened at a comedy club, that one of the 12 people on the International Commission that decides the fate of Pluto happens to be in your comedy club, you know, heckling you. Yeah. And the funny thing is later he said – I didn't say which way I voted. He actually went for the laugh, And he didn't say which way he voted.
That's great.
I'm not sure I know to this day.
So let's talk a little bit more about the museum now. Again, 24-hour grand opening this past weekend. There will be science performed, actual scientists doing their work. What about for people who come in? Because I know one of the things is kids, students will be able to come in and design their own experiments. And what's interesting about it is it's not demonstrations. It's not putting vinegar and baking soda and making the rocket go. That's not an experiment. Because we know how it ends. These are kids who are actually going to be designing real experiments, like answers we don't know yet.
Yeah, you know what I think is fascinating is I think museums traditionally answer the question, what do we know? And then you go in and you learn things. It's like, here's what we know about dinosaurs. Here's what we know about climate change. But what's become like a tagline for the museum, for the NRC, is how do we know? How do we know what we know? Which is a great question. It's like, because you hear something like, here's a question I want to get to the bottom of, for instance. Like, we hear that moths can smell pheromones from a mate like a mile away. Okay, well, that's a fascinating fact. But how can we possibly know that? So that's one of the questions I'm going to get to the bottom of. That is going to be part of my job as a communicator here, is being a go-between between scientists and the public. And I have a lot of weird questions like that. And I'd like to ask the scientists, and we'll present it on audio and video. But how do we know? So you come in here and you don't just learn a bunch of facts. And that's the cool thing about science. Some people might have the misperception that science is a collection of knowledge, that it's a bunch of books on the wall, that scientists are experts and that's what they want to be. That's not what it is. Scientists love the mysteries. They love the questions. And what they really are, you don't have to be intimidated about the idea of like, oh, I could never become a scientist because I could never be that smart. No. What a scientist is, they love the part about being dumb. They love the mysteries. They want to know if something's already known, there's nothing for them to do. What scientists are really curious people who like mysteries. They like to solve mysteries. They like to poke and jab at them and try to figure them out. And in a way, like, you know, the Large Hadron Collider has been searching to find the Higgs boson. And we hear about that a lot. I think Stephen Hawking famously bet against it. He like bet a dollar, I think, that they would not find it. And he wasn't trying to be ornery. What he was saying there was, if they find it, it just confirms this standard model of particle physics. It tells us, it's like we expect to find it, and boom, if we find it, then we were right. But if we don't find it, that's more exciting, right? Because if they don't find it, it means something is wrong, and it opens up all these mysteries. So some kinds of people don't want that. You want to be confirmed in what you know. Scientists would love to have something be overturned. And you know what? I'd have to say that this is exactly why when sometimes people say this thing about there's a consensus about climate change or evolution, and that there's some kind of like idea that scientists don't want to find this because it would threaten their funding. Here's why that is so wrong. If a scientist could overturn evolution or overturn that, what we call anthropogenic man caused global warming or climate change, if a scientist could do that, it would make their career. It would be Nobel Prize winning. Any scientist would love to overturn these ideas. And they're all trying to. And that's even the way, and this is what the kids would learn at the Investigate Labs, is that you'll see how you create an experiment. You create an experiment to try to poke a hole in something. You sort of try to disprove something, and you keep failing to disprove it, and you go, you know what? We can't disprove it. It seems pretty certain.
Yeah, no, I think that's the thing people don't quite understand about science, is that it really is, a lot of it is about overturning everything you think you know.
Yeah.
And that makes it an exciting and a creative process, and a collaborative one too, which is going to be fun to see people kind of working together and not just gazing into their pocket protectors or whatever it is you think they do. So how is this different for you? Now, you were in San Francisco. That's a very nice place to live. You come into the Triangle, which is a wonderful place in San Francisco. How are things going to change for you professionally now? How do you think your new job squares with what you've done before, and what's going to be different?
Well, admittedly, I never thought, living in San Francisco for the past 17 years, I never thought maybe I should move to North Carolina. That was never on the radar. But I had been here twice for an awesome conference called Science Online that brings science communicators to Raleigh, to the Triangle, every year for about the past 6 or 7 years. And I've attended the past 2 years. And in a way, it introduced me to some of the people that it actually – I didn't know when I decided to come here for the conference that it would be – part of the path that led me here. So my onstage experience, my experience making videos and audio production, and my experience training scientists, all of these little threads that if I've had a slightly unconventional path for a comedian. I mean, maybe a comedian is unconventional enough, but even for a comedian, I've taken a strange path. And it turns out every bit of this turned out to be in the job description for the curator of the SECU Daily Planet. So it's like they wanted someone to do all that. And I think I was the only one who did all of these things. So it is different in that it's I've used to being a freelancer and suddenly I'm working for the man. I'm actually working for the state of North Carolina. But you know what? It's an amazing group of people. Betsy Bennett, as I think most people know, is an amazing
director
woman who's the director of the museum. And the entire – and I think one of the best signs of good leaders is they assemble great teams. And so I think she'd already done that with the Museum of Natural Sciences and why it's been so successful for so many years. She chose Meg Lauman, Canopy Meg. She's this canopy. She's been studying for – she's a pioneer in the study of the life that's up in treetops in the rainforest, which was vastly unknown. And so she turns out to be an amazing director who also assembled an amazing team. Together they did. And of all these people – that I'll be working with. It's so exciting. So
well, it's almost proof of what a great project it is to think that there are these people coming from all over the place who have their careers going just fine, have decided to move here for this particular project.
I wouldn't have moved here if it weren't for when I realized what the facility was, and most importantly, are equally important is the people. Is that they are so I find that they're all interesting and everyone is excited about doing innovative work. They are excited about communicating science. They're excited about the science they're doing. And really, what I get to do, I feel like a kid in a candy store because I am coming here. One thing I love to do is interview scientists, and I've done it. I also had a talk show on the internet for a year and a half. Before people were watching web video in 1999 and 2000, I did a show where I interviewed over the course of a year and a half, hundreds of scientists and authors and technologists. So here I am with a chance to do that again. So through my eyes, through my curiosity, I get to – there's so many cool people working at the NRC. And plus we have three major research institutions in the area and other colleges here in the area. So – and probably people not affiliated with any of the colleges. There's so many cool organizations here. Well, we're interested in communicating the science that all of them are doing and sharing it with the public. And I get to take part in that, and I get to have interesting conversations. I get to expand my own universe personally and share that with everyone else. I love it.
Are you going to miss, though, being on the road, having those other audiences and going from place to place?
Yeah, you know, I'm sure I'll still be able to travel some. But no, this is so exciting that you know, why go to them? I can bring them to me. And, you know, in some way, I noticed years ago that being a stand-up comedian and traveling and doing the road, it's kind of like being a door-to-door salesman. And as soon as you, like you have discovered, if you are in the mass media, that's a lot of doors you don't have to knock on. Mm-hmm. I was going around to clubs and speaking in front of handfuls of people or to science organizations. Now, I'm not going to completely, you know, I will still do that in my future. But with all the technology we have to get the message out, I'll be getting the same message out. And I will do live stuff right there in the Daily Planet Theater and in the Daily Planet Cafe. And we have another theater, an auditorium that's a little larger. And who knows, we might be involved in things. Well, with the Science Festival, we'll do stuff all over the area.
One of the interesting things about the Daily Planet is you're going to be able to do real news updates. I mean, it's going to be a place that doesn't just sort of have a standing exhibit or two. You'll be able to adjust to whatever's in the news that day.
Yeah, it is the Daily Planet,
Is there a particular branch of science or kind of science that you're really drawn to that if you could be a researcher, that's the field you'd want to be in?
Well, early on, I think because of the kind of science fiction that I grew up reading, I was always interested in space and physics. But as I've gotten older, I've become pretty much equally interested in other fields. I think that would have been really cool to become a physicist. But I've become really interested. I have a hobby. I enjoy insect photography. And by that, I mean photographs taken by insects, of course. And I particularly like these little hoppers. They're related to cicadas, which most people are familiar with, but there are tree hoppers and leaf hoppers and plant hoppers. They're very cute little things, and it turns out a bunch of people at the NRC specialize in hoppers. So Here's a great thing. I do sometimes regret that I didn't become a scientist. I don't regret the amazing experiences that I have had. And I love where I am. And it turns out I'm going to be able to do something that everyone can do, because there's a we have a Department of Public Science, and it's about engaging the public in doing science. There's a phrase called citizen science that's become quite popular. So online, there are opportunities for people to contribute to actual science being done, like Galaxy Zoo is an astronomy project where just by logging into the website, you can help identify types of galaxies. And so we have a whole department that's in conjunction with NC State. The director is Holly Menninger, who's a great biologist. And they're engaging people in citizen science projects. For instance, I had my armpit swabbed. And so they're going to analyze the bacteria that are in my armpit. They have another project where they'll send you a kit and you can swab a couple places in your home. And we want to understand what kind of bacteria, because this is a largely, here's an area of vast unknowns, is what kind of bacteria are on the door sill of a typical home.
They're discovering great things, too. It's a backyard science, and all kinds of new species are, it turns out, because we love to go to exotic places, mostly, to study the frogs and the little bugs there. Turns out there's stuff in our backyards here in Raleigh and Durham that nobody's ever studied because they're too close.
So I'm actually going to get to contribute to, you know, who knows? I may get to take part in some actual science, even though I didn't formally become a scientist. But and anyone else can, too.
You did discover a new fly, didn't you?
Well, okay, so I didn't discover a new fly, but the discovery is that I took some photos and I uploaded them to a cool website called bugguide.net where you can have a photo identified, a bug identified. And so it turns out a fly picture that I took is not a new species, but it was new to this part of the world. It's common in Europe, totally unknown in this entire region of the world. And so some entomologists in the Netherlands identified it and conferred with a guy from the Smithsonian. And they said, this is the first evidence of this species in the Nearctic, which is this, it includes Greenland and the United States, North America. So it was an interesting distinction. Of course, I said, you know, I took the picture in Golden Gate Park. So it was probably just a tourist. He doesn't live here. It may not be as big a deal as you
actually
think.
I've only got about half a minute left, but why do you think we've fallen so far behind in science in the U.S., if in fact we have, and do you think it's turning around?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't know why people aren't as intrigued with science as I am. I think it's so fundamentally human to just be curious about the world. Unfortunately, I think sometimes it's a political thing that sometimes a fear of science has been manipulated to be used for maybe political purposes. But I don't understand why more people, just everyone should be. How can you not peer out of those little holes in your skull with anything but curiosity? It's like that's all science is. It's just about exploring our curiosity and learning about the world we live in. And it's become really important.
Brian, welcome to the Triangle. So great to have you here.
Oh, it's awesome to be here. Thanks.
Brian Mallow, science comedian, new curator at the SECU Daily Planet and the Nature Research Center at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. You can learn more about him at sciencecomedian.com, and you can find out about the Nature Research Center at natureresearch.org. That's State of Things for today. Our website, of course, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Alex Granados and Sean Wen. Megan Mataferi is our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director. Managing editor, Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.